Infidelity runs in families. One of the best predictors we have for whether a person will have an affair is whether their same-sex parent had an affair at some point.
What does researching human mating behavior look like on the day-to-day?
Yeah, so I'm a scientist at the University of Melbourne. I'm studying for my PhD, and I'm obviously funded there as a PhD student. So that's kind of my day job, so to say. And what that consists of is running studies, so designing studies, running studies, helping other people run their studies, and reading a lot. So a huge part of my day is just sitting down with my reading list and kind of getting through it. Like I've read, like today alone, I've read a few scientific articles, and I'm just kind of working through them. And when we get off this call, I'll probably just get back to that. And then as I'm doing that, in terms of how it relates to TikTok, sometimes I read something that's particularly interesting, or I feel that I've synthesized enough knowledge on a topic that I'm like, let me actually just make a paragraph about this. And then I set up a camera and just quickly say it and then continue.
I love it. What are you deep diving into right now? What subset of human mating behavior are you most interested in?
Right now, it used to be infidelity. That was what I spent the last 2 years on, and we've just gotten some results on that I think that, I mean, it gives me a very clear picture of what's going on related to the various theories as to why people cheat or why infidelity evolved. And so I'm really ready to move on from that topic. I also, it's a topic that didn't really suit me in some ways, because it's mostly being hashed out by evolutionary psychologists. And I mean, some people might say I'm an evolutionary psychologist, but theoretically, I don't necessarily gel with all of their assumptions. I'd get into that, but I promise you it's actually very boring stuff. And then the topic that I'm interested in right now, or just starting to get interested in right now, is actually male beautification. So we see a trend over the past, and maybe I'll abandon this topic. It depends what type of studies are there to be done, and I need to do much more reading before I have a good sense of that. But there is a bit of a strange phenomenon where over the past, say, 50 years, male beautification has really increased in the West. So we see that men's bodybuilding, men's, skincare, cosmetics, fashion, hair, all of these things are increasing, and expectations seem to be rising. So basically, males are, at least in one kind of subset of the world, are increasing their beauty efforts. And we'll see. I mean, I've got some kind of pet hypotheses as to why that's happening. But I'm really interested in how male beautification efforts vary across cultures, and whether that's predictable by certain factors. And there's some evidence that it does vary predictably. But
From your research understanding, what's the catalyst for male beautification increasing over the past 50 years?
Well, this is kind of the unpleasant reality of doing research, is that I could, speculate on this podcast right now, but we won't know until we've actually designed a study and collected data. So, the fun part is oftentimes when I'm doing a TikTok or doing a podcast, I'm really talking about other people's research, because that's the stuff that's already been done where we have an idea. I mean, I could speculate, but I think it's best to leave the speculation for now and just focus on reading and until I've got a testable hypothesis, and then focus on testing that.
From my understanding, much of your deep dive has gone into the infidelity topic, as you talked about earlier on. I remember looking at a little bit of your work and you talking about infidelity being interlinked with heritability. I would love to deep dive into that, especially the intergenerational linkage between infidelity.
Of course. Infidelity runs in families. One of the best predictors we have for whether a person will have an affair is whether their same-sex parent had an affair at some point. Now, a lot of people, they hear this and they think, oh, you know, it's learned behavior, right? They watch their parent do it. And so they kind of excuse that they would do it. Some people have the opposite intuition. They're like, wouldn't seeing their parent make that mistake make them not want to do it, right? Like, so there's some, you know, disagreeing intuitions there. But a lot of people think, oh, it's going to be learned behavior. However, twin studies in a couple populations suggest that infidelity is heritable. Right. So you look at same sex, you look at, I'm sorry, not same sex. You look at fraternal versus identical twins. So fraternal twins share 50% of their DNA. Identical twins share 100% of their DNA. And you see the difference in likelihood, right, that they will cheat because they were raised under the same house. They were exposed to the same stimuli of seeing, you know, their parent have an affair. And so how much of the variance in infidelity is explained by genetics? Now, it's going to vary between populations, of course, not for genetic reasons, just for environmental reasons, right? Like but variance within the population can be explained genetically. So some people have the intuition that if variance within the population is partially genetic, then variance between populations must be genetic as well. But that's actually, there's no reason to make that logical gap, to be clear. But the basic point, the basic kind of result of these studies is that infidelity is partially heritable, meaning there are genes that make you more likely to have affairs. Now, I want to be careful in talking about the genetic associations with infidelity, because a lot of people think, oh, there's a gene that makes you cheat, right? The same way that there's a gene that gives you blue eyes. It's not really like that. It's more that there are hundreds of genes probably that have small effects on your likelihood of making that decision. So let's say there's a gene that slightly modifies your risk-taking propensity, right? Your risk tolerance. If you have that gene, you're probably slightly more likely to cheat. Let's say there's a gene that slightly impacts, and each of these genes will slightly impact many things most likely. Let's say there's a gene that slightly impacts your sexual narcissism, right? Right? How good of a lover you perceive yourself as, how narcissistic you are in bed. That also is going to increase your likelihood of having an affair. Now, my research isn't the genetic research, but obviously I've had to review that literature quite a bit just in order to understand the problem.
Is there a discrepancy between men and women when it comes to infidelity?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we see similarities, but yeah, there's discrepancies as well. The big discrepancy is the rate. Men are about twice as likely to cheat, right? Or 50% more likely to cheat, depending on the study. So what does that look like in practice? Well, if you take a group of married Westerners and you ask all of them, right, have you ever had an affair at any point? And have you ever been cheated on? And those rates converge, which suggests that it's not just self-reporting bias, right? In basically every study, men cheat more than women, and men cheat much more than women. If I were to give an estimate, right, so I've probably at least looked at every study on infidelity incidents, at least every big study, and I would say that it's fair to say that about 1 in 4 men, and maybe as low as 1 in 10 women will cheat on their spouse. But these numbers go up if you're looking. Of course, most relationships aren't marital relationships. Most relationships are dating relationships. And if you ask people, have you ever cheated on anybody ever in your life? You're going to get a higher rate than those numbers. And I think that rate is going to be closer to half of people, maybe a little more than half for men. And we never did a study trying to assess the incidence of infidelity. You'd have to design it a little bit differently. But for what it's worth, we did do, to find participants for our research, we reached out to some 1,300 people from around the world and just asked them, right? Have you ever had an affair ever? And, you know, those that, at least of those that passed the pre-screening and were willing to do the study, about a little more than half of the men had said, yeah, I've cheated on someone at some point. And a little less than half of women had said, yeah, I've cheated on someone at some point. So we see even in that very casual reach out sense, we see the expected sex difference replicate where men cheat more than women. There are also differences in what motivates men to have affairs. So there's some research indicating that when women have affairs, they tend to be relationally dissatisfied more so than men. I don't know how much weight to put in those findings, but it does seem to be true. We also see that men tend to be motivated more by a desire for sexual variety, right? So and this was replicated in my research. So I reached out to, we ended up speaking to about 130 or surveying about 139 men who had actually had affairs at some point. And some of them did say, or many of them did cite sexual variety as their motivation. Whereas women didn't tend to, right? So we had men in our sample who explained their affair by saying, look, my girlfriend was blonde and this other woman was Asian and I wanted variety, right? Like they literally said things like that. There was no woman in our sample, not one, who said anything like, you know, my boyfriend was blonde, but I wanted to get with an Asian guy. So that motivation doesn't seem to compel women to the same extent. I'm not saying it doesn't compel them at all. Women have a desire for sexual variety as well, but it's not as strong as men and it doesn't seem to motivate infidelity in the same way as men. So why do men have this evolved desire for sexual variety? Well, if you're a male mammal, more mates means more offspring, right? So a male mammal with two quote-unquote girlfriends could potentially have multiple mates pregnant at the same time, right? But a female mammal with multiple boyfriends can't be pregnant with multiple males at any one point. And so the benefits of multiple mating to females have to be different from the benefits of multiple mating to males. Now, again, I'm not saying that there's no evolutionary benefit to women from affairs. There are plenty of different benefits. And that's really what my research shows, is that women benefit from affairs in many ways. They don't benefit in the same way as men, but there are many benefits to be obtained.
Makes a lot of sense. Mac, in some of your early research and learnings were around non-human animals. And I'd love to tease out for a moment some of the distinctions between non-human animals and humans around mating behaviors, because just as you mentioned, we're sort of in this interesting group of species that try to select for, you know, one long-term mate. I'm sure there are other animals that do the same, but what have you noticed to be distinctions between those two groups in terms of their socialized behavior or heritable behaviors?
That's a very good question. I don't tend to view humans as particularly unique as a species. There are some things that are peculiar about us, but they're not necessarily unique. So one peculiarity is that we are a socially monogamous mammal. Less than 5% of mammals are socially monogamous. That's quite strange. We also have mutual mate choice, right? So in most sexually selected species, we see that males compete and females choose, right? But in our species, males and females compete for each other, right? So there's both sexes are competing for each other's attention, which in some ways is quite intense and in some ways is actually easier to deal with from the perspective of the animals in the competition. Another peculiarity is language. So I'm not convinced that we're the only species with language. One of my former advisors, Matt Cartmill, said that linguists redefine language every time we find another species that has it. So, you know, we'll discover that a species can use syntax, for example. So we discover that other species use sounds to communicate, and then we say, oh, okay, well, language, you know, needs syntax. And then we discover that other animals use syntax and we're like, oh, well, language needs hierarchical syntax, right? Or language needs to have cultural variation, right? So in some places, some things mean different things. And then we find that animals do those things as well. And so we make new definitions for language, right? We constantly change the definition of language. We constantly move the goalpost to keep ourselves as the only species with language. That said, we do seem to use language in a more complex way than other animals. And we seem to use it in mating in ways that other animals might not necessarily do so. So for example, like you can mate guard linguistically, or humans mate guard linguistically. So one example of this would be, and this is a very unfortunate example, but one example is verbal abuse, right? So people get their mates not to abandon them by harassing them to lower their self-esteem, right? Saying, oh, you're worthless, you're worthless, you're worthless. So that way the person starts to think, oh, I'm worthless. and they stay because they don't think they can do better. That's something that I'm not convinced other animals do. Other animals are violent towards their mates, but verbal abuse seems a little peculiar. Another example of this would be kind of verbal mate guarding, right? Where it's like, oh, da 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 da, you know, don't talk to that guy, don't go out wearing that, you know, share your location with me. These kind of weird higher level forms of mate guarding where no action has actually been taken, just words have been said, right? Sounds have been made, and the mate changes their behavior as a result. Those are interesting peculiarities that that make human mating behavior quite strange. Lying would be another one, especially if we're talking about infidelity. And also information transfer generally, like information flows through our species like water, and so we end up learning a lot about our mates' pasts and about our mates' behavior generally. So if you're an animal and you cheat on your mate, the only way to really get caught, typically, certainly if you're a non-linguistic animal, the only way to really get caught would be to be witnessed in the act, right? And that does happen. I mean, there are cases where, for example, penguins have caught their mate having an affair and they've become violent as a result. But in humans, you wouldn't need to be caught to be witnessed. You wouldn't need to be witnessed in order to be caught, sorry. You could just hear about it from somebody else, right? And that information could be true or false. We also, you know, can hear about what our mates have done in the past, right? Like, so our mate's history is relevant. Like if you're out with a girl and you hear from someone that she cheated on her ex, you're going to be, you know, taking that into account during your mate selection process. And then later, if you end up pair bonding with her in your relationship process. So I think that I've given enough examples there of how humans are different. But truth be told, I'm mostly interested in how humans are the same. So I love it when we find a phenomenon in another species of animal and some clever scientist says, animals are doing this mating behavior. How can we apply that to humans? Does that happen in humans? And then you run the experiment and you find either yes, it does, or no, it doesn't. But in either case, it's quite interesting to me.
Mm. You've outlined some of the aspects of poor relationship dynamics earlier on, from, you know, verbal abuse to physical abuse even. I'm curious also, what are the key indicators of a poor relationship dynamic potentially prior to the relationship regressing to its full extent?
That's interesting. So like upfront things you can use in your mate selection that you might not do instinctively.
Yep.
Well, one thing that I think is actually quite useful, and not just for genetic reasons. I mean, that could be a component of it in some cases, but just for, we know, for example, that, I mean, there's a saying that you're as divorced as your parents, right? Meaning, and I guess we're talking about very serious long-term relationships if we're talking about divorce, but, and that might not be particularly interesting to you, rather young fellows over here. But it is true that, a person's parents' relationship is a great indicator of how they themselves will comport themselves in their relationships. So, people whose parents are divorced are significantly more likely to get divorced. People whose parents cheat on each other are significantly more likely to cheat on people themselves, for whatever reason, it seems to be partially heritable in both cases. We do seem to see a genetic effect, but there's also, likely a social effect. So that's one thing you can use. And then their past behavior, I would say, is, sometimes it's hard to get information on that, but a person's past behavior can be very informative as to how high quality of a relationship they're likely to have. I mean, we just spoke about this actually. Just, you find out that someone cheated on their ex. If someone cheated in their last relationship, they're three times more likely to cheat in their next relationship. And so if, when you're choosing partners, you exclude that group of people, you're reducing your risk by, you know, I mean, if the numbers extrapolate to other populations and in all circumstances, and maybe they don't, but you're reducing your risk by maybe 2/3, certainly significantly. You're cutting your risk down to a third of what it would be if you didn't do that.
How does this idea of male value discrepancies influence relationship dynamics?
mate value discrepancies, right? So that, I'm assuming that's what you're referring to, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So a mate value discrepancy, why is this an issue? So a lot of people think, oh, I want to date the best person I can get, right? That's a very logical thing to do. But if you end up with someone out of your league, they're much more likely to leave, right? They're moderately, it seems, more likely to cheat on you. And it's going to be hard to retain them, right? You're going to put in more effort and they naturally are going to put in less effort. So one thing that we see is that men who are particularly high mate value, men who are, you know, better looking than their partners or better looking in general, often put in less mating effort, right? So we see this effect where guys who are shorter than average tend to be more romantic in their mate retention. So, you know, you can just try and get someone out of your league. And I don't mean just in terms of looks. I mean, in terms of overall mate value. So mate value is everything you bring to the table. But getting someone out of your league can backfire in the sense that maybe they leave you, maybe they cheat on you, maybe they don't like you so much. And maybe you have to treat them better in order to keep them. If you get someone in your league or someone, you know, let's say you're a seven, right? And everyone thinks they're a seven. Let's say you're a seven and you end up dating a nine, right? You're going to be fighting life and death to compete with guys who are nines to keep her. But if you're dating a six, well, you're probably going to have a pretty easy time with mate retention. I'm not saying anyone should do that. I'm just saying that mate value discrepancies are a threat to the relationship. And we do see just out in the world when a mate, because mate value isn't stable, right? A mate value discrepancy can open up. And we do see that, you know, when a guy loses his job, his wife is more likely to divorce him or cheat on him. And it's because, yeah, he had this amount of value as a mate because he was bringing, you know, money to the table, and now he's broke and, you know, he's a dependent. And so, yeah, he's less valuable. We see the same thing where, you know, if a man or woman gets terminally ill, right, or they get sick, it's not a particularly happy thing to think about. But yeah, they're more likely to go through a breakup or a divorce because the person who's with them, right, sees them as less viable as someone to reproduce with. So, you know, these are unfortunate topics. But yeah, mate value discrepancies are a threat to the relationship.
I want to zoom out for a moment, Mackin, to get a better sense of you with relation to your research. I think a lot of times there's a conversation around objectivity in research, but very little is there a conversation around your personal tie to the things that you're interested in. So I'd love to get a better sense of what, for example, in the context of promiscuity and cheating, etc., what was your tie to that initial subject, especially as it started to transition away from research around non-human animals to that subject in particular? And then how is that playing out with your newfound, you know, interest set?
That's interesting. Well, when I say that I'm studying infidelity, especially women's infidelity, people generally think that I've either been cheated on horrifically or I love sleeping with married women, right? But in reality, neither of those things are true. As far as I know, I've never been cheated on. If you know, maybe one of my exes is watching this, laughing to herself. But I don't think I've ever been cheated on. As far as I know, certainly not. And I've never cheated on anybody either. So infidelity, I didn't really get drawn in by that, by any personal event. But people often do ask me, like, why am I studying these topics? And it's kind of peculiar because if I were studying fruit flies, nobody would say, wow, did you have a run-in with a fruit fly that set you off on this adventure? And it's like, well, I'm really studying just intellectually interesting topics. Now, I think that the reason they're interesting maybe does, at a personal level, speak to some, you know, like, it seems very relevant to me. I do live a partially research informed life, because my topics are so kind of irreducibly human. But truthfully, it's not typically my personal life that drives my research interests. There might be a little connection with the male beautification stuff I'm on now. Because I have noticed anecdotally in my life and the life of others that men seem to be competing to be the best looking guy much more than my dad would have competed, and certainly much more than my grandfather would have competed, right? But I don't know if that anecdotal noticing is the same as what you're getting at, which is like personal relevance. And I'm not sure there's a connection.
Yeah, you said in there, you try to live a researched life and live by the research that you move with, which I think is really interesting, especially as we think about the wide variety of takes that come in research communities. I'm sure you've had your fair share of arguments with folks who disagree with you. What does that really look like then? How are you selecting, you know, walk me through Mackin's personal selection process around research that he believes to be valid or invalid around subjects personally relevant or practical for yourself.
That's an interesting question. Well, the conversation of how to sort good research from bad research is a bit of a longer one, and it definitely goes beyond just deciding what to apply in my personal life. I think that too many people look at individual studies as gospel. I always try to note when I'm saying something that's based off one study, and I always try to say it's just one study. You want to look at lines of evidence, right? You want to look at, how else can I say that? You want to think in terms of collections of studies, right? So, and especially replicated findings. So I'll give you an example of this. Research in the 80s suggested that, and before that, suggested that men care more about physical attractiveness than women when selecting mates, right? So that's, you know, there were individual studies showing that. Then they replicated it in basically like nearly every culture on earth, like just tons of cultures around the world. That's an exaggeration, but hardly. Then they replicated it again in the 80s across cultures. Then in the 2010s, this is tens of thousands of people. Then they replicated it again. And now in, you know, I think the last replication was 2020. They replicated it yet again. So across decades, across studies, across methodologies, across research teams, and across cultures, we see over and over again that men care more about physical attractiveness than women. And so if one study comes out tomorrow that doesn't find this effect, it's not really going to affect my opinion on that matter. I'm going to need a lot of evidence to change my mind. And so once you get to that place on any theory, idea, or fact, that's when I start to feel really confident that this is a true thing. Let me think of something more applicable. I mean, the infidelity being partially heritable is an example of that. We have multiple twin studies. We have candidate gene studies, and some of them have been, you know, a little dubious, but they're still there. And then we also see just association studies where it's like, oh, well, you know, if your parent had an affair, how, and these have been in multiple cultures as well and across a little bit of time. And so that's another finding that I feel very comfortable taking to the bank. If a new study came out that showed that it wasn't heritable at all, that would just confuse me. I'd be like, oh, well, that's weird. And I'd want to look at their methodology. Now, some individual studies can be quite convincing if their methodology is very robust, right? And that's what we tried to do with my latest infidelity study. So we pre-registered our analyses. That's when you say what you're going to do in advance, so you can't backtrack. We did it across cultures to begin with, right? We weren't talking to like American undergraduates. We were surveying people in 19 countries. We used valid and reliable scales, meaning that the scales actually measure what they say they're going to measure. And then we replicated their validity and replication, or reliability within the study, right? So we did, and then we also excluded participants, we did double screening. So we knew the participants were who they said they were in terms of their demographics. And then we also within the study tested their ability to do studies, right? So we made sure that each participant, was actually capable of doing, so they were paying attention for one, but also that they knew how to rate attractiveness on scales, for example, because that's one of the tasks we had them do. Like we had the women in our sample, we prompted them to rate the attractiveness of Ryan Gosling, right? Because we wanted to make sure that they understood it. And I think almost every single one said he was attractive. So you can create a single study that I would say is high quality enough that the findings are persuasive, and every researcher should attempt to do that. But more persuasive really is when lots of studies converge on the same finding from independent research groups. And the most persuasive, and this is quite rare, but it's exciting when it happens, is when we see adversarial tests of a hypothesis come up with the same results. So this is when like a research group comes to a problem trying to debunk it, right? They're like, I don't think it's true what your study said. And I'm going to try to debunk it basically. Like I'm going to set up my study so it's much more rigorous than yours. And then I don't think we're going to find an effect. And when they come at it with that posture and still find the result they said they probably weren't going to find, that's very persuasive to me as well. I'd say that those are a few things. And then in terms of when I apply it to my personal life, I'm a little more lenient because it's not like it's a particularly high stakes. And the sorts of things that are applicable aren't necessarily that controversial anyway. Right. So for example, like a huge part of male aesthetics is your shoulder to hip ratio, right? So this is some applicable advice that anyone listening at home can take advantage of. One of the main determinants of your physical attractiveness as a male is how broad your shoulders are relative to your hips or waist, right? Depending on the study. But we find that replicated across cultures, right? Basically, in every culture tested, women like guys with broad shoulders and narrow waists. And it's like, okay, well, if you're working out for aesthetics, right? If you want to look more attractive when you hit the gym, you should be working on the muscles that exaggerate that appearance. So you should be working on your lats, which create that kind of V shape. You should be working on your delts, which actually expand your shoulder to hip ratio. And if you're not that lean, you should get pretty lean women don't like super lean, but there's no research indicating that that's the optimum. But if you've got some fat around your waist, that your ratio would be better if you lost it, then it makes sense to lose it. So that's like an applicable piece of research that's really well supported. That's pretty, cut and dry, straightforward as to how you'd approach it, you'd approach applying it.
So the best approach is to try our best to look like Doritos.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, yeah. So the ratio is, the Dorito shape is desirable. Not a super exaggerated one. I believe the ratio is something like 1.2. It might be 1.5 actually. God, it's just not sticking in my memory. But there is a point where it seems to go past the optimum. But I would say that for most people who aren't on steroids and don't have like really peculiar shoulder or waist genetics, you should be spamming lateral raises if you want to look better.
Spam. I love that. Yeah. I love that. Mackin, I'm so curious. You have a repository mentally that you could just recall very easily. What's your methodology for recalling large swaths of information effectively? Like, do you have a system that you've employed personally to access that? Or, do you review things? Are you doing active recall? Like, what are you doing to keep all this sort of front of mind?
It's an interesting question because my memory, people in my personal life would say that my memory is actually very bad. I was a boxer growing up and I got hit in the head so many times that sometimes it's like my brain just isn't working at the same level as other people. But you're right that in terms of in this one niche, my recall does seem to be fine. I guess I'm just noticing it now. I'd say that I would turn it back on you. Like, what do you have a favorite sport?
Track and field.
Do you have any niche topic that you're really interested in? Because maybe you don't, but I would say that if you speak to a guy, if you speak to a kid, like a child, their brain isn't even developed and they're, have a moderately above average interest in Pokemon, they'll be able to tell you like every Pokemon. They'll be able to tell you like how they evolve, right? Like, or what Pokemon they transform into. If you speak to a guy who has like a moderate interest in cars, he might even be able to tell you whether it's like a V8 or a V6 engine just by like listening to the sound of it in the street. And he'd be able to, recognize all the car brands by looking at the little insignia on the car, tell you all these stats about like their 0-60 speed and things like that. And if you talk to, guys who are interested, I mean, I don't have any of these interests truthfully, but and I guess that's what I'm getting to. If you speak to a guy who is into sports, he'll be able to tell you like all the players on his favorite team. He'll be able to remember the scores of certain games, all these things. And it might be like, oh, they must have some, you might think kind of what you're coming to me now with, which is like, oh, they must have some system for remembering it. They must be, you know, studying flashcards about Pokemon or cars or football or whatever they're interested in. But the truth is that I don't have any of those interests, right? I'm not interested. I'm completely bored by sports. I have no patience for really most topics. Most topics just strike me as I'm not intellectually curious about most things. I don't want to know about cars or anything like that. And so when it comes to like what I'm curious about, what excites me, what I'm interested in, it's whatever scientific topic I happen to be latched onto at that moment. And so in the same, I think it's just that the same part of my brain is running, where it's just a niche hobby interest. And so, you know, some people will hear me, you know, come out with various statistics and facts, and they'll think, God, he must really have to cram for that because he's, you know, it's so boring. But to me, it's not boring. I find it as interesting as you might find track and field.
Mm. I can totally second that. When I was younger, I was not the most focused in school, and a lot of people did not enjoy my presence in the classroom because I irritated everybody because I was just so ADHD bouncing around. But when it came to things like solving Rubik's cubes or, oddly enough, performing circus activities like the Chinese yo-yo or walking on a ball, I was like, this is my forte. So I love that element that you speak to of figure out your intellectual interests and let that guide the way for memory recall. Taking it to a little bit of a different topic, there's this looming concern over the idea of sex, particularly the fact that people are, at least from the evidence and from what I've seen at least, having less and less sex than the past few decades. I'm curious what your take is on how that influences our sexual and social dynamics.
Yeah, I'll just quickly weigh in on the ADD thing. I have ADHD as well, and that was very severe. And one thing that I spoke to one of the world's greatest psychologists, but certainly if you're looking at behavior genetics, he would be one of the top dogs. And he basically described, and I'm not gonna be able to quote him from memory. Apologies, Asher. But he said something along the lines. He said something along the lines of, ADHD people are just more bored by things that don't interest them. They don't actually have attention deficits, because on the things that interest them, they're not easily distracted. They're actually very focused. And so you can think of one helpful way to think about ADHD as a condition is just that, and again, I'm just repeating what he said to me. This is not my expertise. It's that they're easily bored by things that don't interest them. And that creates the illusion of something that people refer to casually. It's like, oh, they're hyper-focused, right? Like ADHD people, they get like hyper-focused as if it's like a superpower. And it's like, no, they're just so bored by everything else that this is what they're spending their time on. Now your question is about the mating crisis. That's what people in my field call it. Different fields approach this from different angles. It's called the mating crisis in my field. Me and my supervisor actually were briefly, and maybe we won't end up doing anything on it, but we were interested in approaching this issue, and maybe we still will. There has been some recent data suggesting, and it's just one study, and you're right that it would be against the trend. So we can think about this the way I was talking about these things earlier. But it does seem that, at least from the most recent results on this, that this trend is reversing, and we see kind of a return to normalcy. Where I actually just spoke to the graduate researcher Alexander from datepsychology.com, and we discussed this on my podcast. So there's some data suggesting that there isn't a mating crisis anymore, and that there's the kind of COVID slump in sex has led to a rebound, which is relatively normal. But I think that there does seem to have been a trend where Gen Z is having less sex than millennials. That seems to be well supported. And it's really part of a broader phenomenon, it seems, where Gen Z is just doing less risky things generally. So I'm technically Gen Z. I'm the oldest possible Gen Z. But our generation has done less drugs, drank less alcohol, you know, rode less motorcycles, had less sex, smoked less cigarettes. I mean, our generation is much more risk averse than the generations before. And there's a variety of theories as to why this is. I know that one historian thinks that it has something to do with 9/11, right? Where basically it's like a reaction to that somehow. I'm not super familiar with her work. Another idea is that it's related to the drop in testosterone that we see, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon. It does seem that testosterone is going down generation to generation, which could have something to do with accumulation of microplastics. But I don't think that theory has any, you know, shocking evidence, so don't take it to the bank. So I guess what am I saying in response to your question? I'm rambling right now. Let me just focus. People are having less sex in Gen Z, but they're also doing less of everything that's risky. And so it's easy to focus on the sex issue and say, oh, it's pornography distracting them, or, men aren't making enough money to impress women for them to want to sleep with them in the first place, da 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 da. But any of those really sex-focused explanations tends to miss out on the fact that it's a broader phenomenon. Sex is a risky behavior. To some extent, you're taking a risk every time you have sex. And it's also, you have to take some risks in order to obtain sex, right? If you're going to sleep with anyone, you have to risk rejection along the way. And so I would say that whatever the explanation is for why Gen Z has been less sexually active, and again, this might be changing, in order to explain that, I think that you'd be best suited trying to explain the plethora of risk reduction that we see. So that would be my answer. Mm. But again, that's not a particular expertise of mine.
Over the past 5 years, I would say, we've seen a rise in a community/subculture called Red Pill. How do you think this has been driving changes in behavior and particularly the mindset influence on male culture?
It's hard to know how much of it is an influence and how much of it is a reflection, right? So because with these, they're doing well on social media. But in order to do well on social media, you have to kind of be a mirror, right? Like, you have to reflect what people already want. And maybe to an extent you can drive what people want. But my feeling is that people watch the things that they want to see more of, and then the algorithm shows them more of it. So yeah, there are these fresh and fit guys, these Andrew Tate guys, those types, some more niche people, certainly. Guys like Rollo Tomasi, who's been around for a while, but is really, gaining some more traction now. These red pill kind of manosphere influencers, and the manosphere is a rather old movement, but it's newly popular, mostly on the coattails of Andrew Tate, it seems. I do know researchers who are working on this. It's hard to know what accounts for the phenomenon. I would say that partially they're changing the conversation, but partially they're kind of reflecting something. It seems to be a bit reactionary in nature. It seems to be some kind of backlash maybe to women's progress. It also seems to be very anxiety driven. So I'm not saying that the people who are creating this content are low value males, so to say, but the consumers of this content seem to be overwhelmingly low value, right? So in terms of, and I mean low value in terms of the mating market. So guys who are really, staying inside watching Fresh and Fit and Andrew Tate and all these guys are not, they don't have a problem of too many women chasing them. Let's just say that. And so their kind of mating market, and this is me speaking very broadly and maybe inaccurately because I haven't, this is me going off my sense based on just being on social media, and it could be misled. Maybe some of these guys are pretty high status, but my perception is that these are disgruntled, low status males, essentially mating market rejects, who are consuming content that promises them a future where, they'll have tons of girlfriends and girls will be fighting over them, da 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 da. Another thing is that this content seems to be overwhelmingly bitter towards women. Now, men who are successful with women generally aren't particularly bitter towards women, right? Men who are successful towards women generally like women, right? And these guys seem to hate women, right? And so a lot of them, and again, I'm really speaking just speculatively here. So I don't want anyone to take what I'm, some of the things I've said on this podcast are very empirically supported. This isn't necessarily one of them. A lot of these guys seem to have gone through some kind of horrible heartbreak at some point and just not fully recovered, right? They've either been rejected by women and been beaten down by that, or they've gone through a horrible breakup or been cheated on or something like that. And since then, they just haven't been able, they just weren't strong enough to take it mentally. And there's you know, we don't get to choose how mentally resilient we are in this life. But it seems that there's kind of a low resilience phenomenon where they deal with something relatively normal, like getting dumped or getting cheated on or getting rejected enough times, and they just become, you know, misogynist trolls and kind of use all this, you know, slut shaming and women hating as a means to soothe themselves, right? So one way of thinking about this is just that women don't like them, and so they hate them back, right? That would be my assessment of the average red pill consumer. I recognize that being romantically rejected constantly must be a very frustrating experience. And so it doesn't necessarily surprise me that some men are going to, quote unquote, fight back. Yeah, I view it as a problem, but I'm not sure whether the problem lies more with the consumers or the producers. I tend not to view social problems as supplier side, so to say, to use one of your business terms.
I like that. I want to dive a little deeper into the social media rabbit hole, a different sub-community, much more of the academic community, the Hubermans, the David Sinclairs, et cetera, that have taken to social media to drive demand for their own research, say, but also to disseminate other people's research. What's your take on this emerging trend, and how do you see people struggling in approaching this? Because this isn't the first time a new medium has been approached by scientific communities, but it is the first time we're seeing mass demand for you know, these academic super deep conversations over large periods of time.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, you'd think that I would have a better insight on this phenomenon given that I'm part of it, but I don't really quite understand it. It seems that everyone's pretty knowledge hungry. I mean, my route to becoming the lowest possible tier of celebrity, let's say that, has been just saying facts into a microphone. Like that seems kind of like I'm just reporting on research, essentially. Like I do very little analysis of my own. That's quite peculiar that works. And, you know, Huberman is a good example of this because he's very famous. And I don't watch a lot of his content, but from what's popped up on my feed occasionally, he seems to do the exact same thing. He seems to sit down with a microphone and just say information. So it's kind of like you're using it's pretty efficient though, as a way of learning though, isn't it? Like you get an expert, like a bona fide expert, hopefully.
Yeah.
And they curate information for you and tell you what it is. I mean, like I'm just not qualified to determine what's good nutrition advice, for example, or what's good exercise advice. Those would be two areas where I just have no academic background. I mean, I'd have the basic qualification of knowing how to search academic journals. But in terms of separating the wheat from the chaff, you kind of need, I mean, people like to do their own research, but you kind of need years, in my opinion, is that you need years stewing in it to get a sense, like an intuitive, it's almost like learning to play chess or a sport. Where you kind of need years stewing in it to get an intuition for like, oh, you know, this practice is a little dodgy. Oh, why did they do the study like that? Or, you know, I'm seeing this one study, but six other studies disagree with it. I mean, I would be so vulnerable if I tried to make a TikTok on nutrition, right? That's Huberman does nutrition, fitness, and like other kind of, it's like sleep optimization stuff. He's like, I don't know what his scientific background is, but he seems very qualified. He's at Stanford. He's got his own lab. But I would be very I would be completely incompetent if I attempted to do his job just by like reading individual studies, because I'd be vulnerable to getting swept up in one result and presenting it as if it were gospel, only to find out that there are 10 other studies that disagree with it. Right. And when I was an undergraduate, right, you know, 4 years of undergraduate, a year and a bit of a master's, and then, you know, and now about it going into my first year of a PhD, it's like that. I remember being an undergrad and writing papers and like citing individual findings. Then my professor being like, hey, there are 6 papers that contradict that one paper you cited. You know that, right? And it's like you need to be in the game for a long time and be sharp in it to actually have a good sense for it. So if you have someone who's credible, you're kind of leveraging their years of built up intuition and leveraging their research ability and communication ability to synthesize and break down like a whole field for you, right? And I guess I guess we'll see where it goes, but it's definitely not it's not Bill Nye the Science Guy anymore, is it, in terms of science communication? Things have gotten a little different. It seems to be more of these bona fide academics doing really niche research on topics that are really relevant to a human life. Like, we don't see a lot of people, like, I guess I'm viral for human mating behavior. There are tons of guys who are viral for fitness. Huberman's viral for like sleep optimization. There aren't many guys who are viral for studying geckos, right? Like that, like the topic seems to need to be applicable. And then the face of the topic, I think, needs to have some communication skill. And then they need to have some background credibility. Yeah. I'd say that those are the ingredients for success, but I'm really thinking aloud here.
The world is also moving generally. You kind of have these two emerging scenarios of experts communicating. And then weirdly in the same vein, but slightly adjacent, is the folks who are learning and sharing their learnings along the way. We see a lot of folks who are like just very raw and authentically, here's what I'm learning as I go. In fact, I have a friend who's over at Stanford who, down that same vein of synthesizing, he's running a PhD right now in physics. And he is just synthesizing his research and putting it out in email. He's just sharing. He's like, here's what I learned this week. Boom. Because a lot of these environments have been so siloed to academic researchers who understand the language, et cetera. But the vast majority of us, you know, sort of can't access that knowledge because they don't have the core fundamentals. So it is really cool to see. I'm wondering, you're a very nuanced guy, generally speaking. TikTok, however, very non-nuanced. Podcasting, definitely nuanced. What have you noticed about the willingness to have a conversation as you're communicating in short periods of time, especially around nuanced conversations like mating behaviors, where a lot of people have emotional charge?
Yeah, this is something I'm very sensitive to, and I've actually enjoyed it I've enjoyed it a lot as a creator, so to say, because TikTok presents unique challenges, but it also presents unique opportunities. On this podcast, I have undoubtedly said sentences that if you fact checked them, I would have turned out to have misspoken, right? Or been incorrect, right? Just because we've been speaking for so long that that's bound to have happened at some point. Also, there are things that if I could go back, I would say them differently to communicate better the underlying truth, right? It's like a genuine gap there. On TikTok, I have this incredible opportunity where, you know, I'm the one editing it. It's really short. And yeah, I mean, I know that your assumption would be that I can't fit as much nuance in there, but I have the unique opportunity to, every time I make a TikTok, I honestly ask myself before I post it, I'm like, really when I write it, when I'm planning it, and then once I've recorded it and I'm editing it, it's like, is every single sentence in this TikTok true? Right? Like every single thing I'm saying should be true, because I had the opportunity to research it. I had the opportunity to write it. I edited it and I posted it. There were so many steps for me to stop myself from misspeaking, speaking inaccurately, saying something untrue. So the base product that the audience is working with, I can defend everything I said, right? I can back it up. And I'm probably the only, I don't even think Huberman has sources underneath his. Yeah. I mean, every TikTok I post, it has the sources coming up at the bottom. Even when I'm interviewed on a podcast, if I go back and make a clip, I find the sources that I'm referencing and I edit them in to make that clip. So So I'm really able to be scrupulous about making sure that everything I say on TikTok is fact checkable by even another expert in my field. Hope to God, you know, like I really do try my best. So if I'm wrong, I'm not going to feel like I, you know, it's like, wow, I made a genuine huge mistake. I don't know how that happened. And then what do I do? Well, in the comments, I try to reply to every comment with a misunderstanding. And if I'm seeing a misunderstanding pop up multiple times, I do my own comment that says, hey, a lot of you people are reading this. Here's the actual thing. For example, so I did a video recently on body count. And its associations with infidelity. And I said, correlation doesn't equal causation, right? It's more likely that the type of person to have a high body count is also the type of person who's more likely to cheat. Not that getting a high body count makes you cheat, right? There's probably not a causal effect there. I don't even know what that would look like. Maybe there is, but I basically just said that. And a lot of people heard me say correlation doesn't equal causation. And they thought that what I was saying was that there was no effect, right? Like there was no effect of body count, like body count didn't have an association. That's not what I said. So then I went back and I added a comment explaining that correlations matter, even if they're not causal, right? Like it's a correlation that someone who cheated in their last relationship is 3 times more likely to cheat in their next relationship. That's just a correlation, right? We can't do an experiment that determines whether it's causal. And I doubt it is causal. It probably just reflects their personality, the fact that they cheated in the past. But that correlation is still a meaningful one that we can leverage. So that's how I handle it. I the way that I handle the resistance to nuance that comes with super short form content is I make sure that the baseline content that I'm putting out there, the kind of foundation for the conversation, because obviously everyone who has the conversation has to either comment or stitch me. So the foundation has to be true at every sentence. Especially with TikTok, since people clip 5 seconds from your video and then make their own video based off that. It's like those 5 seconds better be accurate. And then after that, I try to really educate people in the comments. So that way, if someone opens up the video, opens up the comments, and they're having the same mistake, they see me explain it correctly. I've deleted videos because too many people were misunderstanding it. Because I was just like, well, this isn't educating anyone. I'm actually misleading people. I said the right thing, but I clearly wasn't precise enough. And that's my bad. So let me delete this and I'll make another video later. It was a video where I said women's mating preferences are manipulable, right? Meaning that, and that from a scientific perspective, that means that we can alter their mating preferences by changing the stimuli, right? But people hear that and they think that I'm saying that that manipulating women is good or something. And it's like, all right, well, you know, 50 people have made this mistake. That's a pretty heinous one. Let me re-edit this video, retitle it, and hopefully it won't be read that way.
I think there's a level of maturity when it comes to scientific information dissemination on the internet, particularly because you know, you see other people in completely different subcategories. Somebody who's popped up on my feed quite a bit is this guy who's I think it's called Knees Over Toes Guy. And he just like changes up his, he basically deletes videos all the time because he's like, there's new evidence out there and he's not, you know, scientifically trained. He doesn't necessarily have a degree, but has his ear to the ground and he's constantly updating videos, taking them down, you know, in hopes of preserving the integrity of the content that he posts. So I think it's really interesting to note that point there. To round out this conversation, we typically ask our guests 3 main questions. The first of which is, what is something that you have recently changed your mind on?
I change my mind all the time, but I don't want to say something completely stupid. It's kind of a boring one, but I had the impression that that in human mating behavior, a deeper male voice is always better, and that was cross-culturally universal. And then I spoke to a researcher who's that's really their niche area. And they're like, well, it seems that around 93 hertz going deeper doesn't make you more attractive as a man. It might even make you less attractive. And then in other cultures, we don't see the same effect. It's like in Western samples, yeah, like an Obama level voice depth seems to be optimal. But in other cultures, it might be different. So I was wrong about that. And now I think I have a slightly better understanding.
Second one of what we refer to as the DP3 surrounds around critique and how we handle conflicting opinions. And so the question to you, Mackin, is what message would you impart to a captive audience of your critics, maybe folks in the academic community or folks who misunderstand your content, if they were in the room right now listening to you?
I've got so many critics. I'm not sure that putting them, and they're from such different groups, I don't think putting them in a room captively would be a good idea. They might start to fight. I mean, I get criticized by, you know, kind of social constructionist types who believe that humans didn't evolve, right? Our mating behavior is like, when I say something like there are universal beauty standards, right? There are things that are hot. Like earlier in this culture, I said that broad shoulders are attractive in all cultures. There's some people who are going to get very upset by that, right? And say, no, that comes from the magazines, da 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 da. And it's like, I'm very confident that I'm right about that, right? There's no culture where men with narrow shoulders are just, you know, beloved, right? That's not a thing. But that there will be a group that says that. And then the other group that really criticizes me is these manosphere right wing guys, because I often say things like sometimes the things they say are correct, right? Like I believe they say that looks matter, and they would also agree that there are universal beauty standards, right? So I would say that, and they would agree with it. But they often hear me say things like men cheat more than women, and they just freak out and say that I'm this super biased, crazy, woke liberal who just can't get the facts straight. And I guess if I had all these people in the room, the only thing that I could say, and they wouldn't listen to me, but I would say, I promise you, I'm trying my best to be unbiased and just report on the facts. That's what I would say. I would say, on my mother's life, I am trying my best to say what I believe is true based on my reading of the evidence. I'm not an ideologue. I'm not trying to support any particular view of the world or evidence any particular view. I'm just going off my reading of the data. And sometimes that's going to be wrong. And inevitably, you know, it's going to get filtered through personal biases at different times. But sincerely, I'm trying my best. That's what I would say.
You know, we've talked a lot about challenges over the course of this episode. But we also haven't really talked as much about the hopes of the future. From your perspective, what is giving you hope in the world right now?
I don't know. I'm not a particularly hopeful person. Let's just say that the data is showing that Gen Z is having more sex. We'll go with that.
Level up.
Let's go. Mackin, you're the man. Appreciate you sincerely for coming on the show. Before we end the conversation, I wanted to roll out the red carpet to you, Sean Evans style. How can people plug into your world?
Oh, just Google me. Everything will come up. So there, you know, I could list my handles, but no one's gonna remember it anyway. Just my name's right there. You can look it up.